tamanho chum, eu vou dar um pulo com a paixão com, eu vou dar uma bala pra ir até.
Welcome back to Voices from the Frontline. This is Damon Azali Rojas. We are on KPFK, Powered by the People, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. If you want to know the names of those songs, I don't know. You're going to have to call the Strategy Center and ask Mark Anthony Johnson because he didn't give me the song list. Yeah, I put you on blast on the radio. So we are very excited to have father-daughter team, Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, who is a contributing editor to the Los Angeles Times and a writer, as well as Larry Aubrey, who I've been reading for probably the last 5 years since I've been back in L.A., his columns and the L.A. Sentinel. And he's been in and out doing things around town in terms of fighting for the rights of black folks. So welcome both of you to the show.
All right.
Thanks, Damon. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Larry, I think I want to start with what I saw on the website today. It said, this is on the website of the Los Angeles County Department of Health Services. It says, important notice to residents served by Martin Luther King Harbor Hospital. The emergency department at Martin Luther King Jr. Hospital has closed. There's so much history here that it's kind of like tears you back and forth. And I think what would be good is just to kind of go back to why MLK Hospital was created, who fought for it, and what has happened since 1972 when it was open.
Well, there's a lot of history, back of that, but it's in a kind of a succinct, maybe kind of capsule way. I'll just tell you that, you know, I was around when it was open, and of course it came out of '65, the so-called Watts riots. It was directly out of that. And then, you know, Kenneth Hahn, you know, the good supervisor of those times, quote unquote, really pushed it. He really did. And was one of the main stays there. Anyway, it came there. And two things were there. People should understand that KDMC stood for King, Drew Medical Center. It was King Hospital. Martin Luther King Jr. Hospital, but it was the Drew University of Medicine and Science. Okay, I mentioned it because one is private, is public, and the other is private. So it's another discussion. We'll leave the private alone for the moment. But it's also important. I think we're running parallel things. Anyway, I think the whole thing in a nutshell amounted to a good deal of neglect, a hell of a lot of neglect. As a matter of fact, almost criminal neglect on the part of the Board of Supervisors, the administrators of that place over there, and frankly, the community itself. I don't think they pressured the powers that be sufficiently to keep that thing open. And now the need is as great, if not greater than ever, and people are going to suffer because of that governmental bureaucratic neglect. And I think it borders on being criminal.
So, Aaron, when we talk about the last, say, 2 years since there was the closing of the trauma center, there was the potential loss of accreditation. Now the ER is closed. In 2 weeks, the hospital is going to be closed.
Right.
It feels like it's this whole concept of, well, it's something that's systemically sick, and therefore we're going to start cutting off different pieces to try I think that's my even, I even heard that from Supervisor Burke, who was saying, you know, we have to kill off the trauma center, which is one of the best in the nation, to save the rest, but then not giving those resources to actually save the rest.
Yeah, you're right, Damon. It actually goes back the last 3 years. It's in 2004 was when the trauma center was, they proposed to cut that. And I think you're right. At the time, it wasn't just Burke, but other supervisors said, well, we're cutting off the arm to save the patient, which I thought was kind of strange.
And a hospital analogy in relation to a hospital.
Yeah, unfortunate. But, yes, true, the trauma center was the most expensive unit to run, I think. But that always struck me as a very poor way to, quote-unquote, save the hospital. And as I said in the column I wrote, it galvanized people. I think that was sort of the apex of the protest against closing King Hospital. At the time, it wasn't supposed to be closed, but people sensed it. And they, people sort of knew that if the trauma unit went, then, you know, certainly nothing, everything else was up for grabs. And the trauma unit, the trauma center, was not one of the departments that was being cited for dysfunction or, you know, anything like that. It simply was too expensive to run. And that kind of, that message of cost too much, we have to rein it in, it sounds legitimate, but in the end, you know, what you're really saying is we just can't afford to do the right thing, take care of these people. You know, it always struck me as not acceptable, you know, to say, well, the hospital, we tried to do this, we tried to do that, we just can't do it, so we're going to close it. Always just struck me as the wrong response. And unfortunately, the supervisors, now they're all very used to saying, well, we messed up. We certainly take the blame. But in a way, nothing happens to them. You know, they don't suffer politically. They say, you know, they will say, yeah, it's our fault. But who really suffers? I mean, not them. It's the people in the community.
They don't suffer politically because for those people who are most affected by this whole thing are the least sophisticated, the poorest, and the least politically connected. And so, therefore, that's why they don't suffer. They couldn't do this crap someplace else.
Right. That's true.
So, I mean, in terms of what you say about too expensive, who's saying that? Was that the supervisor saying that? And then the secondary question would be, then where was the money going instead of going to the hospital? Or
you know,
where was it moved away from the hospital to?
Well, I'll just say, Mike Antonovich said more than once, we're just throwing good money after bad. And really, the whole issue of money was so prominent. I know the county's always in trouble financially, but there was such, particularly after the Time series ran, you know, the expose on King,
mm-hmm.
people, you know, and there's a whole, as you know, the whole background of this is there's a very anti-public sector kind of, you know, feeling out there. And if it's public sector that's supporting poor and or colored people, they're usually the same. You know, people, there's this real sentiment of, let's just close it down, you know. And the implication is, you know, these people, you know, we are wasting money. They don't deserve it. It's not going well. And so they take the business approach, and you know, if the business is not working, so let's shut it down. But this is a public hospital that should actually have more resources than most, more attention, because it serves the most vulnerable people. And we've really gotten away from that and sort of made it to this business model. It's a broken business model when, in fact, it never was a business model to begin with.
So, I mean, yesterday, Larry, there was an article about you in the L.A. Times, and in it, there was a quote that you said that, you know, blacks need to hold their leaders accountable for improvements and demand their place in a multi-ethnic political spectrum. And I think the dilemma that comes in my head is when I was reading the stuff around who showed up at the supervised board of supervisors, it was like 200 people. They spoke public testimony for 6 hours. Really recently, you know, in May, when there was the MT board fare increases, 1,500 people showed up.
Mm-hmm.
When you have this kind of almost, it's almost like it feels like it's a giveaway to the supervisor, because supervisors sit on both boards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, oh, we'll give you your public comment, we'll let your voice be heard, you know, after your minute to 3 minutes, depending on which board it is, they're like, thank you, and then go right along doing what they want to do in the first place.
Right. See, I think that was Aaron's point before. You know, the thing that the whole mobilization around the trauma center closure, you know, it was a fait accompli. And this is the same thing. This was a requiem people attended, not a protest. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It was a funeral, you see. And incidentally, people of color had nothing on the table, my friend. When this is the I told you about, this is a top-to-bottom accountability issue here, not just the board, not just the L.A. Times. Which played its role in the closure situation. But we played a role, or didn't play a role, sufficiently. And that's very important, because what I'm saying is that it's one thing to talk about what happened then, but that's what I meant before about the kind of juice. The political juice does not come from poor people who need it the most. Unless they get so pissed off, unless they get so mad that they revolt. Follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Then you see, then you hear, and then you see the tragic outcome of all that. Or sometimes it's not tragic. But my point is that what I'm really saying is that, and I think Aaron made that point earlier, is that, you know what, you know, just they had made their minds up, you know, made their minds up on a basis of information. I'm going to tell you something. Look, man, that board of supervisors is, to me, the prime culprit. And then it goes down. And I think, you know, we're all involved on a collective sense, I think, in that. But the board is that, and specifically Supervisor Burke, whose district the hospital is in, right? I'm simply saying, I'm not talking about just, you know, dumping on Burke. I'm telling you that she did not meet her responsibilities, in my opinion. She didn't meet it. Just didn't meet it. You know, period. Because, you know, look, what I'm really saying is that it, you know, the leadership question. It's one thing if you go out there, you try, you might, you do what you have to do, and you fail. Listen, you do what you've done, and, you, and whatever you could do. That is not the case for, I think, her or that board. And I'm simply saying that if there were those people out there, if we out there were of a different view, if we were, if those were white folks out there, and of some, at least some with their needs, you have to go class as well as, you know, have to be middle class, right? You know, I'm not so sure they care about poor white folks either. So, you, but if it was a West Side type situation and so forth, you all know what I'm saying. So I do believe that we have to keep in mind, though, that the equation includes us as well. It really does. Those of us who at least, care enough to be out there. The protests are only one phase. We have to talk about what's going to be on the table. There was never anything put on the table by people of color, and particularly, specifically black folks, as far as I know. And I was tracking that thing as a supporter all along, all through all those meetings that, Matthew Waters held and so forth. I missed very few of those, and I was there, so I saw.
So Larry, what is the kind of tactical campaign game plan to actually, which, because what I think blame is from top to bottom, but really what we need to do is politicize the people who are most affected and try to get power for them and encourage them to actually develop that. So what would be the tactical plan to actually do that? Because I feel like I totally understand, and a lot of the same issues are the same thing. It's like the people who are in jail, the people whose families are getting broken up by the criminal justice system, they still don't have power in society. So how do we actually politicize these communities so they can actually then hold?
Ernie can speak to that. I do. I should, not my, my brief response would be, you know, organize. But, you know, Ernie.
That would be my response, too. But my father's already said this. But I think that it can't just be the poor people at the table or you know, the people most impacted by this, unfortunately. It has to be some of the middle class. It has to be those people, unfortunately, who've not been there, because you need everybody in the fight to, you know, for healthcare, not just for healthcare, but for other fights as well. And it's really that absence of the middle class, because in a way they don't see their interests as being, they don't see King Hospital as sort of central to their interests, you know. And I don't just mean, of course, you know, they don't live in the neighborhood, they don't go to King. That's not my point. It's that they don't see it as worth saving for whatever reason.
So you wrote a really excellent op-ed in the L.A. Times on August 15th called King Drew, an Abandoned Cause. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the role of the middle class, as you were saying, in terms of bearing the responsibility because they abandoned, they weren't going to the hospital, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But when, in your opinion, did the black middle class's interests divert? Class interests divert from the black community as a whole?
Well, my father can speak really specifically to that, but I think, as I said in the piece, it's just been happening 40 years. I think it actually started happening the moment the hospital opened, or actually a few years before that, when the middle class started to build. And I think that, you know, and I've said this before in other pieces, but the crisis that black people have that I see is what I call in the column a crisis of interest. What are our interests as black people? We all know about the class divide, okay, but when it comes to things like this, this is where we really see that division. You know, what do we stand up for? And I think that most black people, you know, whether they're middle class or not, they will publicly say, I support King, you know, and I support his right to open. But they don't go much beyond that. It's all lip service, kind of like Yvonne Burke herself. And, you know, she's really just kind of a metaphor for so many of us. And that's the problem. And that problem, that crisis of interest, to me, has been going on for decades. And it's sort of reached a, you know, like I said, King Drew, really, what's happened there has really made that evident.
That's the irony. That's one of the ironies of a quote-unquote integration, desegregation. This didn't exist way back, for example, when I came in the 40s in this town. Everybody was in the quote-unquote, I mean, I'm overstating this to make my point, but everyone in the black situation was in the same bag. I mean, lawyers, you know, lived next to garbage people and to cafeteria people, et cetera. That's the way it was, because that's the way it was segregated here in Los Angeles. But now what I'm saying is, not to dwell on that, the thing of it is, right now, the chasm, as I mentioned in my piece, the chasm between middle class and poor blacks is greater than ever in history. And it's not hard to see why, in terms of access, in terms of action, and what all those things. But the problem with that is that black, many middle class black folks, many, if not most, if not all, look askance. You know, can you do, how many do you say, as I mentioned in my, how many black folks that really middle class folks go past the Harvard Freeway, go east of Harvard Freeway? Not many, my friend. Not many. And so that's the real, the problem is we're working at a real disadvantage because we don't have everybody involved. And I don't know how you get everybody involved. I have no magic wand, but I'll tell you something. Whatever's happening, it has to be because people have, Aaron, like Aaron said, they have to have an interest. And that interest has to be explicit. It can't be assumed. It has, everybody has to say, look, we all buy into part A of this, whatever this thing is. You get that kind of value, you can move from there. But then it becomes a piece. You can't assume that people care. People, at this point in time, as far as I'm concerned, people don't care that much. And incidentally, people rarely talk about, you know, the thing is the demographics that came through. King House, that area, that catchment area, is largely Latino now. 60-70% Latino. Okay? Mm-hmm. And where are the Latino leaders in all this piece?
Right. That's a good point. And, Damon, I'll say, you know, even though it's obvious that the black middle class has failed in this situation, even if none of them ever lift their finger, does not absolve the county and the government of its responsibility to run that hospital. And, I it's not either or, in other words. And I know we know that, but I just wanted to say that.
I mean, it's interesting because I think it's the whole concept, what you were talking about in terms of after integration, is this, do you rise up as an individual out of the community, or do you mm-hmm. rise up with the community? And I think...
Well, not only that, the discussion here, you know, can't get into all this, but I'll throw some things out that people need to think about. I mean, people need to think about, you know, the fact that it's okay to be Afrocentric, as far as I'm concerned. Not only is it okay, it's imperative. I think it's okay to be Latino-centric. I mean, that's life and living. It sure is okay to be white-centric, right? What I'm trying to say is that
for some
that
people,
game about it doesn't really matter. Race is not that important. That's a bunch of nonsense. Race is a seminal issue any way you look at it. And I'm just saying that's the point of embarkation. That's the point to start to get people acknowledging that and moving ahead. I mean, you know, I'm going to tell you something from my point of view. When we talk about Kingu, the black part of that, I'm not a Latino thing, but I mean, I worked with Latinos, as you may very well know, for many years, probably as much as anybody in this town. But let me tell you something. Unless blacks take care of themselves, nobody else is going to do that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Nobody's going to do that. Why? Because it's not a primary interest of anyone else's to do that. And the same thing would be hold true for Latinos. But I can't speak to that. You understand my point?
And at this point, there's not a strong enough movement that then will make people notice black people.
That's my cut on it. Yeah, unfortunately, my cut on it. I mean, and incidentally, what about the elected officials and the leadership generally? I'm just throwing these things out because it's a protracted discussion that we need to have. But I mean, the leadership, the thing, and I hate to say, sounds cliche, like a cliche or something here, but you know, the lack of accountability, and I still think that's the kind of thing that goes on at that board, a board of supervisors. You know, I mean, they're just getting yourself the bureaucrats. The bureaucrats are doing what the heck they want to do, and the board is, I don't know what they're doing. But I can tell you one thing: I do not believe that black people are a priority for the government in Los Angeles County, or in the state of California, or in this nation. Still, I don't think. I think it's more of a rhetorical priority than an actual, real priority.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being on the show. I think why I wanted you both, because I think that you are very understanding that black people need to actually talk about being black and the agenda and the interests of being black, but then also making those bridges and understanding that other oppressed nationalities can also be pro-Americano.
What I was really saying was that it is necessary to deal with that before you can effectively collaborate with others. You understand what I'm saying? I'm saying it's necessary to deal with what you are and who you are before you can effectively collaborate with anyone else. How can you be acceptable to somebody else if you aren't acceptable to yourself?
We'll leave it at that.
All right.
So I want to thank Aaron Aubrey Kaplan and Larry Aubrey for joining us. We are on 90.7 FM KPFK. In Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and we'll be right back with Michael Novick speaking about the Black Writers Liberation Party. We'll be right back.